I think that is one of the least, like, offenders of terrible slang.
Give
to
me
be
something
honest
worse.
With you.
I think it would yes. be actually yes.
I don't mind that so much.
Yas queen.
In fact, I have two close friends. We haven't. I don't think we've really said it in person, but we text that sometimes.
You're all monsters.
Terrible.
I think a great, like, Halloween costume actually would be to get a bunch of, like, cheap lampshades from, like, Salvation Army and you are throwing shade.
Oh my god. Applause. That was so good.
This will be my lazy Halloween costume.
But, you know what? You know what, Brenda? That was good AF.
Thank you.
It's good
I
AF.
Can even. Thanks to you guys. I can even.
Oh god, Brenda, you just turned into 15 drag race gifts. Welcome to Why Watch, the podcast where three buddies drink a themed cocktail to a deeply flawed movie and then attempt to fix it while pretty buzzed. I am Chris, whore of Babylon Ravel.
I am Lee. I got soul, but I'm not a soldier, Delahanty.
And I am Brendan, teen horniness Trishler.
And the movie we watched tonight was the follow-up to Richard Kelly's Donnie Darko titled Southland Tales, a movie that tries to be many things at once and, like, what, like a quarter of the way succeeds at, like, each of them?
Sure.
Sort of. Charitably.
Various measures, mostly failure.
We have a lot to get into in this one, and I do want to note before we go forward, we have a gigantic organizational chart that we put together of the characters and their roles in this movie and how they relate to each other. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of prominent questions on it.
Yeah.
But before we dive too deep into this very colorful, thorny pit of questions, let's talk about the cocktail we made for tonight. Pretty simple one by our standards. It was a Vinique Glow, which was a
peach-flavored
Moscato vodka blend that we mixed with a unsweetened white mint tea. And we garnished it with a little bit of peach.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty fitting.
It's called Fluid Karma. I liked it. It was not as sweet as we usually skew, and it was cool and refreshing.
We basically took, like, unsweetened tea and then sweetened it. That's what it tasted like. It tasted like I went to the store and I bought, like, an honest tea peach tea.
It does. Well, and it does sort of taste like we added peach schnapps.
Well, yeah, I didn't taste, like, I tasted zero alcohol. Like, it just tasted like...
That's also because I definitely filled up your glass with more tea than Vinique.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we,
how dare you?
Here's a little peek behind
Smack
the
Smack
him. Ow!
Hit him again.
Ow, Lee, why?
Kick him in the groin.
Oh, Lee.
I didn't hear the high voice.
Well,
when you guys were researching Revelation, I went out and had three more shots of Vinique Glow.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow, so you're, like, ready to go.
I really wanted to be as not sober as possible when we talk about
you
this movie.
You are RTG right now.
You could have told me. I would have done, like, just a straight shot of vodka or something.
Because,
like, I would happily be drunk for
you
this.
You guys, do we want to take, like, a shots break? Like, that's cool.
No, I'm
fine. Okay.
I don't need a headache for the rest of my night.
Yeah.
So, you guys, so if I were to try to grapple to describe this movie in very general terms, I would say that it is both a condemnation of the post 9/11 world, and also an adaptation of the Book of Revelations.
Revelation,
but,
singular.
Sorry, Revelation. But because that is probably too obscure, I'm going to throw it to our dear friend Brendan to try to summarize this movie.
Right.
And I do not envy your task.
So actually, what I did, and credit where credit is due, there's an article on Salon.com called Everything You Were Afraid to Ask About Southland Tales, written by Thomas Rogers. And he has a very lengthy and detailed synopsis. It's a great article to read, but I've pared it down as much as I could to try and condense this. But everyone, hold on to your seats and try and follow me here.
Get ready, guys.
So, Southland Tales opens on July 4th, 2005 in Abilene, Texas, as home video footage of a bright light appearing through the windows and a mushroom cloud rises in the distance. We find out that Abilene and El Paso have been nuked, and we get a Fox News-style summary of the following 3 years in this alternate universe. So after the nuclear attacks in Texas, we reinstate the draft, and by October 2005, war breaks out with Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, North Korea, and Iraq. And pilot Abilene, Justin Timberlake, the film's narrator, is injured in a friendly fire accident. There's a blockade that impedes oil coming to the U.S., which causes an increased demand for alternative fuel sources. As a result of this, the Republicans win the November 2006 elections by a landslide and create USIDENT, which is a think tank that monitors TV, the internet, and basically all security cameras. Liberal extremist cells start to emerge, including a group called the Neo-Marxists. In the 2008 election, which is being fought between Clinton Lieberman, prescient, and Elliot Frost, who are the Republicans, the election hinges on the electoral votes of the state of California. In June 2008, Boxer Santeros, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, an action movie star with ties to the Republican Party, disappears. 3 days later, he's discovered in the desert near Lake Mead. We first see Boxer waking up on a beach near the Santa Monica Pier. Above him, Pilot Abilene sits in a gun turret and recites from the Book of Revelation, Robert Frost's poem The Two Roads, in an inverted version of T.S. Eliot's Hollow Men. He will do this consistently throughout the movie. Later, we see that Boxer is in a relationship with Krista Now, Sarah Michelle Gellar, a former porn star with a reality TV show. Together, the two have written a screenplay called The Power that tells the story of the end of the world. As the U.S. runs low on gas, renegade scientist Baron von Westphalen, Wallachian, and his company Trier have built an enormous machine off the coast of California that generates an electromagnetic field called fluid karma. Surrounded by his entourage, which includes Serpentine, Biling, the Baron's mother, Dr. Inga von Westphalen, Dr. Katarina Kunstler, and Dr. Sobernex, the Baron explains how fluid karma works by quantum entanglement. In reality, fluid karma pumps a liquid called fluid karma out from underneath the Earth's crust that runs in a serpentine pattern around the world. At a beachside restaurant, Krista Now meets with Cindy Pinzicki, Nora Dunn, a porn producer with ties to the neo-Marxist movement, to discuss her marketing plan. In addition to a reality show, Krista has launched an energy drink and recorded a hit single called Teen Horniness Is Not a Crime. When Krista mentions she's sleeping with Boxer Santeros, Cindy decides to use this information to blackmail Boxer's father-in-law, Republican candidate Bobby Frost. Nana Mae Frost, Miranda Richardson, the wife of Republican candidate Bobby Frost, inaugurates the Los Angeles USIDENT headquarters. We learn that Boxer was kidnapped at a charity scavenger hunt several days earlier, and a charred body, presumed to be his, was found in the desert near Lake Mead. Zora Carmichaels, Sherry O'Terry, a member of the neo-Marxist movement, buys blank bullets from Walter Mung, Christopher Lambert, in an ice cream truck filled with weapons. At their Venice Beach headquarters, we meet the rest of the neo-Marxists, including Veronica Dream Mung, Amy Poehler, and Dion Element, Wood Harris. Elsewhere in the building, Ronald Tavener, Sean William Scott, is in the bathroom and looking at his reflection. As he waves at himself in the mirror, he notices that his reflection's movements lag behind his own. Roland Tavener, his racist cop twin, is unconscious in the main room, having been kidnapped and drugged by the neo-Marxist. As part of the neo-Marxist plan, Ronald must pretend to be his brother Roland and accompany Boxer during his movie research. With the help of Dion and Dream, Roland will help stage a double murder that, when caught on tape, will incriminate Boxer and destroy the Republican campaign. Ronald arrives at the home of movie producer Fortunio Balducci, Will Sasso, to meet Krista and Boxer, who explain that they have written a screenplay called The Power about a paranoid schizophrenic cop named Jericho Kane. Ronald agrees to take Boxer for a ride so we can research his role. As they drive, Boxer explains his screenplay also involves a miracle baby that doesn't produce bowel movements. Tavener says that he hasn't produced a bowel movement in 6 days. Unfortunately for the neo-Marxists, their operative and USIDENT, Kenny Chan, has been compromised. His colleague, Starla von Luft, has planted a bug on his jacket and is leading police forces to their hideout. Meanwhile, using a sex tape given to her by Krista Now, Cindy blackmails Frost for money and demands the passage of Proposition 69, a bill that restricts USIDENT's powers. The police break into neo-Marxist headquarters and kill Kenny Chan. Roland manages to escape, climb onto the roof, and fall into a dumpster. At a restaurant, Ronald tells Boxer that he has been dreaming of him. While Ronald is briefly distracted, Boxer is beckoned over by Serpentine, who has been hovering nearby. He follows her to a bookstore where the rest of the Baron's entourage is waiting. They claim to have read his screenplay, and according to Serpentine, the future is just as he imagined. Starla von Luft, the double-crossing USIDENT employee, is reading a copy of The Power at Work. Starla is in love with Boxer, and in a fit of delusion, assumes the persona of Dr. Muriel Fox, a character from the screenplay, loosely based on Krista Now. Back in Venice Beach, Boxer and Roland pull up in front of a house while Dion and Dream pretend to fight inside. According to their plan, Boxer is to videotape their fake murder. Unexpectedly, police officer Bart Bookman, John Lovitz, pulls up and shoots both of them for real. Boxer and Roland run out in a panic. Boxer receives a phone call from Starla von Luft as Dr. Muriel Fox and tells him to call Vaughn Smallhouse, one of Frost's assistants. Vaughn sends a car to pick up Boxer and bring him to the Frost mansion. Roland, meanwhile, has picked up Zora and Bing Zinnemann, a new member of the neo-Marxists who assisted with the staging of the fake murder. Bing is freaked out and decides he no longer wants to be part of the group. Zora abruptly pushes Ronald from the car and runs over Bing. Later at the headquarters, we discover that Zora and Bart Bookman are lovers and have planned the murder of Deanna Dream. Back in the dumpster, Roland Tavener wakes up as his hands begin to glow. He climbs out and walks to the nearby ice cream truck. Walter Mung recognizes him and quickly sedates him with an injection of fluid karma. Boxer walks up to the Frost Mansion where his wife, Madeline, Mandy Moore, and the Frost team are waiting for them. Although he recognizes Madeline as his wife, she remains unimpressed and demands to know why he disappeared. Krista is brought to the mansion where the Baron admits he has been paying Krista to deceive Boxer, but also mentions that Madeline is pregnant not with Boxer's child, but the child of Brandt, one of her father's assistants. When Krista leaves, Boxer receives a phone call from Starla instructing him to go to the Santa Monica Pier, while the Baron phones Simon Theory, Kevin Smith, an old bearded man, and instructs him to remove the body from Utopia 3. Through Pilot's voiceover, we learn that he was injected with fluid karma in Iraq as part of an experiment by the Baron. In his quest for global domination, the Baron has negotiated an agreement with the Minister of Japan, Hideo Takahashi, for fluid karma. As part of the deal, the Baron has Serpentine cut off the Prime Minister's left hand. Meanwhile, Pilot meets with the son of the surgeon who reconstructed his face, Martin Kefauver, who exchanges pot for fluid karma. Abilene injects himself with fluid karma, collapses, and in a dream sequence, dances a routine with sexy nurses to the Killers, All the Things You've Done. We learn that July 4th will be the launch date for the new Trier Mega Zeppelin, dubbed the Jenny von Westphalen. Krista now stops by Zora's to buy some drugs when she notices the tape of Dream and Dion's murder on a chair. Thinking it's a sex tape with her and Boxer, she takes it with her. In his Hummer, Martin has learned he's about to be drafted to go to Iraq, and is about to shoot himself in the head when Ronald persuades him not to, and the two decide to go to Mexico. Cindy meets Vaughn's small house at a restaurant and gives him a copy of the sex tape. When Vaughn threatens her, she tells him that she has multiple copies and tasers him in the balls. Boxer meets Starla von Luft at the Santa Monica Pier. She tells him that he must board the Mega Zeppelin, and what he's looking for is in the Baron's private chamber. Then she pulls out her gun and threatens to kill herself unless she can give Boxer a blowjob. Pilot Abilene, who has been watching the scene from his gun turret, shoots and kills Starla. Krista decides to make her sex tape public by placing it in a neo-Marxist Dropbox. She's pursued by Zora and Bart, who've discovered that Krista has taken the murder tape by mistake. Nana Mae Frost is also monitoring the situation from USIDent. When a confrontation erupts near the neo-Marxist Dropbox, Zora and Bart are both killed by a soldier. Boxer meets Fortunio on the beach, and it turns out that he's been on the Baron's payroll all along. He injects Boxer with fluid karma and transports him back to Madeline. Neo-Marxist cells have begun to converge in central Los Angeles. Violence erupts throughout the city. As the party in the Mega Zeppelin kicks off, Boxer heads upstairs to the Baron's secret chamber. There he meets Simon Theory, who tells him that the screenplay The Power is correct. As a result of the Baron's Utopia projects, the Earth's rotation is slowing down and the world is coming to an end. This has opened up a rift in the space-time continuum on the outskirts of Lake Mead. The Baron decided that the first human to travel through the rift would be a movie star, and that movie star would be Boxer Santeros. He had Roland Tavener kidnap Boxer and drive him through the rift. As a result, Boxer was duplicated. One copy of Boxer traveled 69 minutes back in time, while the other copy was killed by an explosive charge in the car. Ronald and Roland Tavener, furthermore, are not twins, but copies of the same person. If the two Taverners were to touch, the fourth dimension would collapse onto itself and the world would end. Unfortunately, Martin and Ronald's Hummer soon collides with the ice cream truck carrying Roland. Walter Mung is killed, Ronald is shot in the eye but survives, and Roland runs to meet him in the ice cream truck. Their hands begin to glow. As they hold hands, the truck begins to float into the sky with Martin on top of it. Fortunio and his buddies break into USIDent, killing all the employees, including Nana Mae Frost. And on the Mega Zeppelin, Krista, Boxer, and Madeline perform an abstract dance number. This is interrupted when Boxer pulls out a gun and threatens to kill himself unless everyone evacuates the Mega Zeppelin. Outside, the ice cream truck levitates upward. Martin climbs on top of the truck and launches a missile at the Mega Zeppelin. Just before it hits, Boxer's tattoo of Jesus on his neck begins to bleed through his shirt. Inside the levitating ice truck, the two Taverners continue to hold hands. One repeats, "Friendly fire," while the other says, "I forgive you." Pilot Abilene says via voiceover, "Revelation 21. And God wiped away the tears from his eyes so the new Messiah could see into the new Jerusalem. His name was Officer Roland Tavener from Hermosa Beach, California. He is a pimp, and pimps don't commit suicide." Oh, Roland's eyes turn gray, and the movie ends.
Oh my God, that description, that doesn't even begin to express how interminably long this movie is.
No, and that's as good as it gets. Yeah, this is as uncomplicated as it can be made, and this is uncomplicated in the sense that it follows plot from A to B, not uncomplicated in the sense that you understand motivations or why characters are at a certain place or doing certain things.
So I know that, like, not all movies have to do the three-act structure.
Right.
This movie does not have a three-act structure. There's right. There's no arc.
In fact,
no.
doesn't it go from 4 to 5 to 6?
Well, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah,
that's irrelevant.
Doesn't really matter, but, like, there's no, like, you can't, it's kind of hard to pinpoint a protagonist and what his journey in this movie.
Right.
And I think that like, maybe you, like, there's experimental films and other forms of storytelling that don't necessarily involve that. Like, there's anthology and other things like that. But, like, I think the movie suffers from a lack of, not necessarily a three-act structure, but a
coherency
structure?
Yeah. No, I agree. One of the things we would always do when we were in school is there, did you, like, do, like, the eight beats of a story?
Yeah.
I could not tell you for the life of me what the eight beats are for here.
Because
like,
you can't even find out who the character is
right.
to follow.
I don't know who the protagonist is. Presumably the protagonist is Ronald or Roland Taverner.
Yeah, we don't spend a lot of time with
him. Yeah, the Rock boxer gets a lot more screen time, I think,
yeah,
than that.
And we don't know who
for
to
the uninitiated,
who to root
such
for.
As me. Mm-hmm. What are the eight beats of this
I could not,
story?
I don't remember them.
But like,
it's just the idea, it's like, in theory, every story should break down to eight beats, where
it's
like introducing characters, inciting events, you know, like denouement, like...
All right, so rising action fight. I mean, this is typical fiction.
Yeah, it's
there's,
just
there's
it's
a million
standard stuff.
Ways of like there's a bajillion schools of thought about like what the points are and what they're called.
Yeah,
like, Kurt Vonnegut did a thing on it. I don't really.
Well, but like I know from like in written fiction, it's like what you said, inciting action. Then there's rising action, climax, falling action, denouement.
Yeah, and there's ones that are like movies are even more structured than novels, and that some to that extent sometimes. But
yeah.
like the thing is that I don't even if we say that like Ronald's the protagonist, it's not he doesn't know what he's doing the whole movie. He's just kind of stumbling around, being told what
thing
to do.
Thing to
right.
thing,
and there's no like there's no quest or arc or story.
Okay, actually,
journey.
I want to start there because Roland slash Ronald, these two of the same person but from different.
Which is the one we follow
continuums.
Mostly? Is that Roland?
That is my question. Which one is knocked out in the ice cream truck for a
Roland,
great deal of it?
Roland.
Okay, so Ronald is the one that we follow.
Yeah,
like,
this is important because this is very important because Ronald is the one that should not exist. He was created
as a dupe.
As a dupe, Roland was the original.
Right.
So Ronald
right.
is the one that's
right.
having anomalies, like his reflection is wrong and he's not having bowel movements.
Right.
Because...
And the original Roland
right.
is the one who's knocked out on drugs for like 95%.
Yeah,
of
Roland is the one who does nothing for him.
And his
movie.
Eye gets shot.
Yeah, his eye at the end of the movie, he gets shot in the eye.
Oh,
but
okay.
Boxer, his dupe was killed.
Yeah, almost immediately.
Yeah.
There was some sort of contingency plan that they
someone
posted.
Online somewhere said that the boxer is fake, but no. The fake boxer, the new boxer is dead. The old original boxer is the one
who traveled back in time.
And his dupe occurred through the same circumstances as the Roland
Ronald.
Well,
the Taverner was the one driving the car. Taverner drove a car through the rift with Boxer in
right.
it.
Right.
And so that's why there are two copies of each of them.
Right,
or,
okay.
Yeah, there are two of each of them.
That element to me is so unnecessary.
I think, is it safe to say that this is, like, the strangest, most abstract movie we've ever attempted to tackle?
Yes.
Like,
probably.
And probably, I hope for our sake, will continue to always be the strangest, most abstract movie we've ever attempted
and
to tackle.
And I have to be honest, there are parts of that I love. I love a movie that is super ambitious and tries to tackle some big shit. And this movie does attempt to do that. It is... a political commentary, it's a satire, it's sort of a comedy, it's also sort of an adaptation of the Book of Revelation. There's a lot happening, and I like a movie that attempts to grapple with that, but I just found it to be a mass of blinking lights that my eyes had a very difficult time following.
Well, I don't think that the connections are all that. I don't think that all the things that he wanted to connect were like, very good connections. They're, like,
no.
weak. Like, I wrote down there, like, how this is sort of, like, what the point, what we think the evolution was, which was that it was about an actor who was going to get conned by a bunch of... It was just
Hollywood
be,
types.
Yeah, Hollywood
yeah.
types. It was going to be, like,
right.
all cynical, like, fake,
yeah,
corrupt
Boxer
Hollywood
was,
types.
Like, the one consistent
yeah.
throughout all these
Because he seemed to be the stooge who's being pushed around by higher powers, including Krista.
Yeah.
Who was sort of shoving him into things.
But, like, in the original draft, this was a comedy about an actor
that.
Who was just getting duped by a bunch
and
of
then,
people.
And then
like,
they added...
Else.
Then Richard Kelly was like, the Book of Revelations is really cool. I want to, like... I want... Actually, this is going to be, like, a Book of Revelations story.
Yeah.
And then after that is when the sci-fi and...
9/11
post-9/11
yeah.
world stuff came
oh boy,
into play.
Oh, boy, you guys.
So,
okay.
like...
So
I think that, like, Boxer is sort of this, like, hanging... thing from, like, the original idea
right.
that, like...
So one would assume that Boxer is the main character.
But he's not really... I mean, he is in terms of screen time, but in terms of what the movie appears to think is the central character, he's not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's worth, like, spending a lot of time trying to figure out who the main character is. I think that the problem
it's
is
an ensemble
we can't figure
piece.
It out.
Yeah.
That's how it builds itself, is an ensemble
yeah.
piece.
Right, it's a crazy... There are so many... There are more characters... who you see and who have names than we have mentioned, I think, in the synopsis.
And,
yeah.
by the way, having so many named characters confused the shit out of me.
Well, there's just
I didn't
too many.
Know what to make
yeah.
of it.
We don't need this many characters.
No, there's a lot of... There are so many characters that could have been condensed into one.
Yeah.
So
I know that Richard Kelly felt like he had a lot to say, and that's why he did all this supplementary
right.
material and stuff.
Yeah, because we should also mention that, like, as Richard Kelly was making this movie, he was also writing three graphic novel, prequels to go along with this movie. And the movie, during the opening segment, segment references these things off to the side as there's like a news screen.
Yeah.
There are three, like there are Roman numerals 1, 2, and 3 with the corresponding graphic novels, and they will be highlighted periodically as events that are referenced from those graphic novels show up. So like, he had a lot that he wanted to say here, so much that it could not be contained in this one movie.
Yeah, and I do know that he had all that in his head. He wanted it. He thought it was all important, but at the end of the day, like, what you don't get is you get a mess, but what you can see is that there's, like, there is some story happening, there's some sort of element, and you can easily see that not all of it is necessary
right.
to get that story.
I think, honestly, though, like, on that, a really good way to give people, like, an idea of what this movie is, it's, like, Donnie Darko amped up to 8,000. So, like, it's, like, if you saw Donnie Darko, just imagine everything to be 8,000 times more prevalent. Like, there were a few characters there who followed a more or less linear, like, I don't want to say, like, a linear per se story, but, like, a story that you can follow. Now imagine that with, like, so many more characters who all have their own stories that they're following.
That zigzag.
Like, if you liked, like, the music in Donnie Darko, well, we're amping it up even a whole lot higher.
But also, instead of teenagers, now they're all adults and politicians, right. And it falls apart really quickly because right. you can't realistically think
well, because
that
it's teenage behaviors and mindsets projected onto these grown adults, some of which are well into their 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part where I really disconnected from this movie, where to me it felt like a middle schooler giving me a lecture on the Bible and
yeah, that's what
politics.
Happens when you try to apply that tone and that style to a political satire,
right.
that it comes across as very, like,
smug,
101.
Smug but unearned. Almost as if the story believed it was more educated than it really was.
Well, it's like anyone on really high on weed, like...
Like lecturing you on politics.
Yeah.
And you're
like
if we just did this, everything would be fixed. And you're just seeing that, it's like, no, you fucking idiot. There's 8 million reasons
just
why
it's
not
the case.
Just
erase debt.
Yeah.
There'd be no debt.
Yeah, we'd just wipe out national debt, and then we'd all be fine. If they just, like, eliminated college, like, student loans, then we'd be all set. Like, fucking no.
It honestly reminded me of, like, of pothead objectivists who supported Ron Paul because he was going to legalize weed, but Ron Paul was like this. He appealed to this person who approached politics and life in a very round, uncomplicated, high on weed all the time kind of way. And that's what this movie felt like, where it had a very simplistic black and white way of approaching these issues that just made me feel like, no, you're immature.
Yeah.
I'm not on board with anything you're saying.
It really doesn't nail the politics at all for me. And I wrote on the board, like, the two sides, you know, Marxists and Republicans, and I wrote people in between, ? Because there's, like...
Are there?
There's
Do
no
they
shades
exist?
Of gray. Like,
no.
All we see are crazy people, like,
yeah, you
on
see
either
extremes,
side.
But nothing else.
Yeah. They're, like I said, the only two sort of, like, voices of reason you get are two amnesiacs.
Ish.
Yeah. They're two amnesiacs who can't really be much of an audience surrogate for us because they also don't know what the fuck is happening.
Yeah, they don't even know the context of the events happening around them.
Yeah.
Neither do we.
They're just struggling to understand them.
See, I would think that, like, in theory, Pilot Abilene should be a voice of reason too, but Pilot is physically in the movie so little. He has a lot of voiceover, but Justin Timberlake was on set for
one day
and all of his scenes were shot in one day. So you can imagine that for something like this, like, how much screen time that translates to. And while you hear him saying things a lot, you don't see him very much. And frankly, I feel like it seems like this character should be a voice of reason.
This character is one of the more important characters in the story.
Right, but
he's
and
minimized.
Yet, yeah, and yet, he's so not there.
He, like, this movie needs more of that character.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
By the way, that had to have been a very long day of shooting, because...
It was, like, 16 hours.
I was going to say, even though he's not in the movie that much, what he is in... I mean, he's in an extended movie music video.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which he said it, they got four takes.
Yeah. Which
four
is still, frankly, impressive.
A long time.
Yeah, like, to do it in that few.
Yeah.
Like, kudos to you guys.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a lot of setup involved, because there's so many long takes.
Right, there's a lot of long takes.
But then there's another take at that same location that's a separate thing.
Yeah, where the Martin Cafalber bit.
Yeah.
Well, where he's partying.
Well, yeah, that's just like a thing
at the end.
Yeah. That's
with,
like,
Janine Garofalo, who pops up in this movie for no
God,
reason.
Can you imagine scheduling this? You had to get Janine Garofalo there that day too.
Yeah, I know. Come out at like 11 p.m. to Santa Monica and
put on these fatigues
and just, like, dance around with Justin Timberlake.
JT's
for a couple
gonna
minutes.
Finish his last scene, and then
she's like, "Do I get any lines? Do I get any lines? We're gonna tape them. We might not use them, but we're gonna tape them."
Well, then she would have other scenes. So, but, like, to get like, if JT was only on set for one day, but then that one scene also needed her.
Right.
That's insane.
So the other important thing to say here is this movie premiered at Cannes at an incomplete state. So, like, there are special effects not done, and the movie was about... Yeah. The movie was about 20 minutes longer. Currently, it's what? Like,
it's,
I
like,
say,
oh,
like,
it's still over two. It's
very,
like, 144 minutes or
something. Yeah, I want to say it's like over 2.5 hours, I believe. And around 20 minutes of it were cut after Cannes. It opened at Cannes, and it was booed, which is...
Yeah.
like
that's a bad course for
Cannes. Yeah, Cannes, there's always a movie that's booed at Cannes.
Yeah.
But after this was done, they decided to, they had to trim subplots, they had to change things, they had to like finish some special effects. So there's the prologue, as you see with like that Fox News infographic, is completely different from the original prologue.
Interesting.
Janine Garofalo's character is almost entirely cut, aside from when you briefly see her at the end, no lines with Timberlake.
Yeah. Just sort of vaguely gyrating in the crowd with
She has a lot of interactions with Simon Theory, Kevin Smith's character.
Yep.
And even that, there are just like snippets of other scenes cut. Like there is, so as long as this movie is, there is more to it that you don't see, and there is more to it that it was not filmed.
So we have a lot happening. We have, okay, so can we generally describe, because we've kind of dipped our toe into this a little bit, what is the political situation in this movie?
The Republicans are 100% in charge.
Right, Republicans control the legislative branch.
Yeah. Now, this is a logical thing. That,
George
like,
W. Bush is president.
Yeah, if we had,
yeah,
if
they
we
used
had been
that
bombed,
news clip.
Yeah.
Like, if we had been, like, attacked by, like, terrorists, and there'd been, like, a nuclear bomb explosion, then it's really reasonable that, like, the far right would have been able to get...
Well, they seize control.
They, yeah. Yeah. And enforce all the sort of identity shit that, like, is happening in the movie. Like, there's no freedom of the internet anymore.
Sure. Right.
It's actively censored.
Right, US ident censors everything relating to media.
Yeah, and this is like, I'm on board with it so far. It's
plausible. And we have Miranda Richardson playing the evil queen head of surveillance, sitting in a literal monitor room, constantly snacking and watching all the feeds like it's reality TV.
Yeah. Right. Now, if I can briefly mention a shitty movie that had better politics than this.
Yeah.
Batman vs. Superman. Like, the senator in that movie was at least like a plausible character for
You're
me.
You're making a hard sell.
I'm saying it was
Let
a bad
go.
Movie
Let
with
go.
Better politics than Southland Tales.
No,
are
you
saying
I'm following
you. That's
I agree.
Hard?
I'm following you. Keep
yeah.
going.
I agree.
But the senator, Holly Hunter, yeah. I get Holly Hunter confused with another person.
Jodie Foster?
Probably.
Laura Linney?
But I like Holly Hunter.
Yeah, I like Holly Hunter
yeah.
too.
I mean, she's great.
Her character made sense in that, like, you kind of got this impression that it was going to be this, like, government against Superman thing, but, like, she was actually
a practical senator.
Pragmatic
yeah.
Democrat senator that was like, hey,
This is crazy.
We should have
bananas.
Freedoms, but like we should talk about the fact that like you're doing all this stuff unsanctioned and it affects politics and the world.
Yeah,
it was a very like we yeah. just want to talk to you, Superman.
It's a rational concern for someone to have.
Of course,
yes, and like it was dealt with much better than like this idea that like Republicans take over and then liberals go crazy and are terrorists.
Yeah,
well, they go crazy and they're stoned terrorists, which
ineffectual.
Which
but,
I
yeah.
well, but I loved because it's. I mean, obviously, this movie deals in cliches and extremes clearly, but. I just love this idea that people, they're high on weed, seemingly constantly, yet they're pulling off these terrorist schemes kind of successfully.
Yeah, I mean, some of it goes off
in a messy
way. I think, like,
but...
definitely, like, Dion and Dream are not, like...
No, yeah,
they were,
some
like,
of them are more
stooges.
Capable than others.
Can we just have a quick sidebar about Dion and Dream? They were great.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the acting is amazing.
Yeah, Amy Poehler was so good.
Can we say, like, it's a great cast, right? Like,
yeah.
you would look at this cast and you, like, see there's so many talented people playing really interesting characters.
Nora
yeah.
Dunn was hysterical
right.
in this movie.
There's, and yeah, Sherry O'Terry, like, there's a lot of SNL alums in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, Richard Kelly's talked about how, like, a lot of actors agreed to be in this movie because they were playing characters against type. Like, John Lovitz plays a policeman who's, like, very, like, a badass, like, because
yeah.
he was
with
policeman.
Bleached hair.
Yeah, and he, like, it's just so great to see John Lovitz, who was, like, this, like, goofy sort of guy, like,
right.
playing, like, this, like, hard-nosed, like,
right.
badass,
do you
aggressively
fuck?
Masculine.
Do you want to fuck?
Or do you want to watch a movie?
That line was amazing.
When she, like, sits with his hands around Sherry O'Terry's neck.
But it's totally serious. I get the idea that, like, that's a serious question. Like,
yeah.
if she had said, like, let's watch Jaws, he would have been
like
oh, okay.
great, let's watch the movie then.
And also...
What's on Netflix?
It's also, I mean... You could have used that line in normal days too, where it's like you're hanging out with someone and like, hey, do you want to fuck?
Is that like
movie?
Is that the 2008
Netflix
like alternate channel? Reality version of Netflix?
Yeah.
Fuck and watch
fuck,
a movie.
Fuck or a movie.
Fuck or a movie. That's what I think it is. It's like this. He fucking took some food karma. He predicted Netflix and chill.
In a weird way, like there are a lot of things here that are weirdly relevant to
yeah.
like.
Yeah, no, I think that the political climate of now is of importance to this movie.
I
like,
would also say as
with
oh,
the fact that both sides have to some extent become radicalized.
Right,
there's
like
elements on the right and the left.
Yeah, like I mean, I imagine we'll be going back to like interviews with him a lot, but like he's basically said how like now like. in this day and age, there are people, like, there are radical fringes who call the president a socialist and believe that he's a Muslim and think that he's, like, this radical far-left figure when, like, nothing politically is indicated.
No, not at all.
And, like, that there are, you know, like, if you had, like, written into the movie, like, Donald Trump runs for president, like, what a ridiculous concept.
Yeah,
it would have fit in, like, so, like, perfectly well with this goofy, ridiculous movie, and yet here we are.
Right. Yeah. I do think there is a solid case, or an interesting idea to merge this crazy political climate with the themes of the Book of Revelation.
Yeah. I do agree.
Just in terms of, you could even just put it in metaphorical terms of the end of an era, going into a much rougher time, of feeling like you're on the brink and everything's about to end.
Yeah, and if anything, though, if you look at the Book of Revelation as a sort of, like, truth and fiction, like, approach, like, all it's really saying is, like, is the whole idea that the Antichrist or the false prophet is this charismatic figure that becomes the ruler because everyone just loves him, that's just kind of, like, that just happens in history. Like, right. A lot of people are able to achieve, you know, power and because they talk a good game, but they're actually corrupt and it's like awful people.
That's the idea of being a demagogue, of demagoguery, which is...
Yeah, so it's really just like...
So how does that fit into this movie?
On our whiteboard here, we have a list of, like, biblical figures from the Book of Revelation and who we think they correspond to.
Let's run down the cast, how we believe the figures of Revelation, how they translate into this movie.
I did the color scheme, so let me go through here's how I did this. So the ones in black are ones that are basically confirmed from Richard Kelly or through, like, obviousness.
Okay.
So the Antichrist is Baron von Westhalen. I believe that's
Wallace
actually
Shawn's character.
The inventor of the thing that is the sort of ending
karma.
Our world.
Yes.
Yeah. Boxer Centauros is the false prophet messiah. We know this. This is the thing. The second Christ is definitely Roland/Ronald Tavener.
Mm-hmm.
Unclear which one or both.
Yes.
The dragon is definitely Serpentine.
Right.
Absolutely.
Westphalen's aide, Bai Ling.
Bai Ling, who does appear to kind of be influencing scenes in a passive way.
Right. So just real quick, I want to throw in, according to Richard Kelly also, Serpentine is actually the person pulling all the strings here.
Yes, also.
You think Baron von Westphalen is in charge, but Serpentine, because Baron von Westphalen's character wants to rule this post-apocalyptic society from his Zeppelin and just sort of, like, rule over everything that's falling apart down below.
And he knows
Serpentine,
it's going to happen.
Yes. Serpentine, on the other hand, realizes that he knows this, and in an effort to thwart him, decides to have the apocalypse come about by having Roland and Ronald touch, causing the end of everything.
Anyway, the Whore of Babylon is definitely Kristen Al.
Yeah.
Because she's got the cup, which is the energy drink, the cup of whatever.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Right. Yes, her cup of, like, all her sins and crap, yeah.
I love that, her stupid energy drink.
Now, almost for certain, the witnesses are Dion and Dream, because
Pilate mentions witnesses, and then we immediately show Dion and Dream.
Yes. There also is mention, along with the dragon, there's a mention of the beasts, and this is before a scene where all these characters are. But we're just kind of spitballing that the beast may be the Senator Frost and Von Smallhouse.
Just to explain the rules very briefly, Senator Frost is the Republican candidate.
The vice president. He's the vice president.
Yes. And then Von Smallhouse is another party, kind of a parachick?
Mm-hmm. He either has ties to Frost's campaign or he has ties to Trier and Baron von Westphalen. It's a little unclear because we see him with both.
But he's in the room always.
Yeah, but he's with them and he knows stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And now we're going off the board here because this is stuff that Richard Kelly either hasn't talked about or important things in Revelations that aren't really...
Directly explained.
But, like, we feel like...
Well, Maddie Frost.
Maddie Moore is playing the pregnant woman.
Right. There's a pregnant woman mentioned in the Book of Revelation.
Along with the beast and the dragon.
Yeah. And she straight up says at one point, I'm pregnant with your child. So, there we go.
She probably is that.
And she is the only one to be evidently pregnant in the movie.
Yeah.
So we have that. Now we get into...
Territory. There's one instance where...
Let's talk about the four horsemen.
Well, yeah, what I'm going to say is there's one instance where Pilate quotes the part of the Revelations that talks about the rider, the death horse, the pale horse and death. Now, because only because the witnesses thing where he says the thing about the witnesses and then we see Dion and Dream, he says the thing about death and then we are introduced to the gun dealer, Walter Mung. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's the significant, but I wrote down either Pilate or Walter Mung because I feel like Walter Mung isn't that significant, but...
They both deal death.
There's significance in the sense that that line is spoken before his scene, like, or Zora. Technically, Zora's in that scene too, but, like, I just wrote down either Pilate or Walt.
The thing is also that there is an argument that could be made that Pilate is war, because Pilate, the Horseman War is mentioned wearing a white robe with bloody flecks on it, and during the Dream music number sequence, he's wearing a white t-shirt with blood on it. Also, you can make the argument because he was a soldier that he represents war in that sense too. You can make either case.
Yeah, so that's why for war, I wrote Martin Kefauver because, there's the idea that he has a sword, which was the rocket launcher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could also, we wrote that, like, there's an arrow with, like, a question mark to swap war and death, because right. they could be swapped, but there's an argument that to be made for either of them being war, because Martin Kvelder is also drafted into the war, and right. that's what prompts him to sort of, like, go on this
freak out.
And you could also argue his death because he kills a bunch of people at the end of the movie. Like all of the cast at the end is killed by him.
Now, because we had death, which was talked about, we did war, and then we also put down Famine and Pestilence.
So, Famine and Pestilence was those were two that we wish-washed on a little bit.
Yes.
Well, I think we wish-washed more on war and death.
We did. I think it was, we didn't have a clear person for us, but once we hit on the person,
I wrote down Simon because I remember Simon Theory for Pestilence is responsible for the idea of injecting fluid karma into people as a drug, and he was responsible for the soldiers taking it and going on missions.
Which could be argued to be this disease.
Yeah.
Right.
Or a pestilence upon these people.
And you had mentioned also that his legs are somewhere, rotting somewhere in Iraq.
Justin Timberlake has voiceover in a deleted scene where Simon Theory, who has no legs and is in a wheelchair, Pilot mentions that his legs are rotting somewhere in Iraq.
Yeah, and also, he's got white hair.
Yeah, completely dresses in white, long white hair, white beard. So let's go to Famine.
Yeah, so Famine, we hit on Naname and Starla because they were both seen eating a lot.
Yes.
But they also,
while doing the same thing.
Because
while
they were
watching
both,
these surveillance screens.
Yes, because they were both basically, observing life instead of living it. So it was sort of like a form of starvation that they were going through. So we decided on Naname because she's...
While constantly feeding themselves.
Yeah, because Naname is more of like an important figure.
She's dressed in black also.
On the black horse.
Yeah. And Naname has a high collar black outfit, whereas Starla is wearing a clear plastic windbreaker. And Naname also is a more important figure in terms of her role in the society.
Yeah.
So it seems more likely that Naname...
You really don't need Starla.
No.
I mean, one of the things, like we had said, that's the character of Starla, it's surprising to me that of all the cuts that were made after Cam, that the character of Starla made the cut. Because really all she does is at one point she phones The Rock and says, call this phone number, it's Von Smallhouse, so that they can come and pick you up and take you to the mansion, which could have been covered any other number of ways during reshoots. So really, her
and
character...
And then she dies.
She dies. She shows up again and talks to The Rock, says, I want to suck your dick or I'm going to shoot myself, and then she gets killed by Pilot. So really, any scene with her could have been cut pretty quickly or down to almost nothing, else could have covered it.
You could have had Naname call him and to deliver him into their hands.
So, and then there's one other character that I wrote down for a sort of Revelations of, parallel that I thought was interesting to talk about, because the Book of Revelation is, narrated by Apostle John, who's, got this sort of vision of this prophecy.
Sort of the storyteller.
Yeah. So, it almost makes sense, if Pilate is not the soldier of the rider of death, or he also could be the Apostle John, because he is our narrator. He is describing the end of the world before it happens.
Yeah, yes. As it happens.
He knows, he knows what is happening.
He knows what's happening, because of, and again, it's because of this, fluid karma.
Right,
context, it's because he sees the future because he takes fluid karma.
Right, fluid karma allows you the ability to look into the future, look into the past, and provides you with some sort of mental link to other people on fluid karma.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, and I...
And
this
him
is
being
a
an apostle and being friends with, Ronald actually kind of tracks.
It fits.
That does track.
The second coming of Christ.
But also being distanced from them.
Yeah.
Because John wouldn't have known the second coming of Christ, he would have known the first one.
Yeah.
But that would actually, now it's making more sense why we have Roland and Ronald, because would one be considered the first coming and one is the second?
I don't think so. Because Revelation is not really so much concerned with the first coming as it is the second.
Yeah. I think that's just a sci-fi way of dealing with the second coming.
Yeah. Okay. I think also, so it should be said at the end, whenever Roland and Ron are holding hands and they're repeating friendly fire, it's not your fault, I forgive you, that there's sort of an interesting parallel of the idea that he is achieving forgiveness through himself.
Yeah.
So, he is giving himself
that's
forgiveness.
That's what I had thought about, is that when he says it's a parallel of, Christ forgiving sins, but what is interesting is that in this modern interpretation, it's more about forgiving yourself,
right?
Which is sort of beautiful.
He has guilt because he is responsible for Pilot Abilene being disfigured in friendly fire. He inadvertently caused Pilot to have some facial lacerations that were repaired later on, and he feels tremendous guilt over this.
Yeah,
he looked like an adorable war scarred satyr.
I mean,
that Pilot Abilene.
Pilot's fucked up mentally too. He's clearly got PTSD. So I think there's a time. I don't know when you want to do this, but I think we need to talk about what was good in this
movie.
Okay.
So actually, sort of There's a couple of things written on the board that I kind of want to do with you. Like, so obviously, are any of these people good?
Yeah, I wrote
speaking
that
of things
above,
that are good.
That's really tough. Yeah.
I wrote that above neo-Marxist, people in between, and Republicans because, I'd had a limited understanding of Revelations, the source, the sort of inspiration for this, and if there was a sort of like good versus evil thing happening, as there is in a lot of Christianity, but what I was wondering is, like, are either of these sides that I should be rooting for? Or, like, is this just a cynical worldview of, like, everyone is,
in a,
is
way
a bastard?
In a way, it's interesting because it almost seems to posit that the world will end not in a battle between good and evil, but in a battle between two morally relativistic sides that have gone so extreme that they've met at the same kind of, like, horseshoe diagram point of fascism.
Do we want to go round robin and name characters who we feel are good-hearted people?
I think there's a pair we can agree on.
I just want to throw in also that there's the concept that people in this world have become more extreme because of the utopia fluid karma experiences, which are because the Earth's rotation is slowing, people's brains are being fucked up. So, like, possibly there are no people in between. Everyone is on one extreme or the other because this is messing with our brains.
Which, in a way, has homogenized them because they can all agree on a point of being extreme regardless of what those beliefs are.
Like, you see other people when they're at restaurants and things like that. Like, maybe those are the people who just have no horse in this race whatsoever.
I'm gonna just nominate. I think Roland and Ronald. I would argue those are good people.
I think they're
caught in strange winds. They don't know how to navigate, but they are good people.
I think there's a case to be made that Pilot is not necessarily an evil person or a bad. He doesn't seem to.
He's definitely twisted by his experiences.
Yeah. He seems like he needs help.
I think
he's
started,
been like battered by the world.
I think he started from a good place. And that his trajectory got messed up, and maybe he's landed in not such a good one. But
yeah,
I think
he seems like he's sort of lost hope. Like he seems like he's sort of fine with everything going to shit.
He's very much a wayward sheep.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
he does support like Roland / Ronald. So like one would like you could argue that by doing so, he is like an inherently good person, albeit one who's jaded.
Yes.
And hopefully, we're hoping that in recognizing the goodness in Roland / Ronald, that also makes Pilot good as well. So we have three, but technically two people who are good in this world.
And now, like, here's another thing I want to talk about, because I want to mention that Krista now, there's moments, towards the latter half of the movie where she sort of seems like she's...
Regretful.
Like, she seems like she really cares. She really just wants to make sure that Boxer doesn't get hurt.
She does seem to legitimately care for Boxer.
But here's where I want to talk about...
she put him in his situation.
The Boxer and Krista, a lot of people on that side, right? They're like... I think what their problem is that they're not evil, but that they are, like, vapid, self-centered, and ignorant.
Shallow.
So, like, they think that they're doing good things. Like, Boxer thinks, he's, like, gets into this head that he's this Jericho King, and he's gonna, like, I don't know, save the world or whatever.
Right. He believes he's an action hero.
Yeah, and Krista now thinks that she's, like, tackling important issues on her talk show. But she's, you know, she's
just,
not,
it's like,
helping.
Yeah, it's
they're literally just talking about anal on her talk show.
Well, no, it's not even that, because, like, at one point, one of her porn star friends is talking about how, like, what if, like, I just want to ask the Supreme Court that if you had sex on a plane, you took the morning after pill when flying over the international dateline, would it be the morning before pill? And they're all like, that's a really good point. And she's like, yeah, the Supreme Court can't answer that. So it's like, it is people who think that they're saying very profound, like, deep, meaningful things.
And I think that's where the satire really hits home the best, because it's it's delivering this sort of harsh message that, like, hey, having good intentions doesn't get you anywhere if you're an idiot.
Right.
You're too stupid to know what's actually the
I would
right
also
thing to
say
do.
That it makes the point that good intentions don't just justify whatever you're saying.
No.
Like, just because your heart's in the right place doesn't mean it's okay.
Yeah,
it's like
you can still say really racist shit and not mean to say racist
exactly.
shit.
Exactly.
But, like, you know.
Yeah, I think actually, also just as Sarah Michelle Gellar's portrayal of Krista, I think is a really good.
Yes.
It's one of the many really good portrayals, because she really gets, like, who this character is, who is, like, this sort of, like, vapid dope who thinks she's being very profound and intelligent when really she's just has nothing going on.
And
I think she sells it really, really well. And she, like, there's a lot of her scenes that are legitimately funny.
Very.
And she gets the script, I think. If she might not get the entire story, but she gets her character.
Also, hair and makeup on her was perfect.
I've taken another look at the board. I don't think anyone else is actually. I couldn't
I'm not
confirm
sure
anyone
else
is good.
You, I think there's if you're going to go like some Dungeons and Dragons because I think that there is some sort of argument that providing what you know about Serpentine and her intentions to end the world,
she
that
could be chaotic good.
good because like she doesn't want this Antichrist in charge, and so like she wants to end the world because it is the best option that she has available to herself.
Yeah,
right.
Like it's either you have a lunatic who's ruling over the ashes, or you stop everything. Mm-hmm. And her response is to stop everything. So in a weird way, she could be considered like chaotic good.
Yes.
I would also nominate Cindy Pinzicki as chaotic good.
Yeah, she seems to, like, yeah. She doesn't seem to know everything that's going on, but she seems to be, like, she seems to not trust the government. Yeah.
Justice seems to not care what bodies get killed on the way to, in that path.
No, not necessarily, well, but she doesn't really know about the violence going on. She's the one that says when you've gone too far.
Yeah,
but she says it so casually. Terry, you've gone too far.
Well, I think it's like, it's a weird sort of like motherly concern that she says the line with at the end.
Is there a thing, is there a valid idea behind the fact that like the people on the airship don't seem to be going batshit crazy? Is there like, are they not affected by whatever's happening on the ground?
To the guess not. Maybe.
It's weird.
It might just be like the case, like everything is escalating on the ground, therefore they're all escalating. So like when these people are all above it,
I mean,
like,
would they not be sort of like the ruling class while everyone else is going nuts?
I guess, but the idea is that like the currents are actually making people mentally unstable. Yeah. So why are the people on the airship seem
relatively
so,
okay.
so normal?
I was going to say, I just really like the idea that that whole you've gotten too far was your Paulette line of this.
Claudette line,
sorry, yes. Paulette. Okay, who else would we say is...
I don't think there is.
Like, yeah. Contrary, like, maybe Kefauver, like, in some minor way, because he just seems, like, sort of
like,
innocent
like
in a way.
Like, neutral good?
Yeah, like, he's not, like, actively bad. Like, he just seems to be more sort of self-interested. Like, not
say,
even self-interested,
I would say
but
he's
like,
almost Pilot Junior, where he's also fucked up by his experiences, and he's caught in a current that is maybe not a good one, but I wouldn't say he himself is evil. He's acting of what I think he believes is a good thing to do.
No, I mean, it's weird in the end that, like, you get... It's weird to be handed a rocket launcher and then instantly know what to do with it and then be okay with doing it. That's when...
And
that's
then
when
jumping
the,
off to your
that's
death,
when the movie
apparently.
Goes off into that surreal thing where I start to, like, lose it in terms of believing it.
Boy.
So, right, but, like, contrary-wise, if you're asking, like, who do you think is evil, like, you can make arguments for anyone else.
Simon.
Like,
I think
Zora,
a lot of them are truly terrible people.
Yeah. I think that's the case, too. Like, Zora Carmichael's, like, order, like, basically has Dion and Dream assassinated.
Yeah.
Dion and Dream are, like, if they're not, like, bad people, they're very self-absorbed.
I think they're harmless
they're self-absorbed.
Yeah. And, like, you know, like, everyone else, I think, on this board, you can certainly make an argument
for
being... For
evil.
Yeah. Evil, or at least just, like, self-absorbed to the point that they don't care about anyone else.
Boxer, the only one I would say is Boxer sort of outside of this equation?
No, I think Boxer is part of this self-absorbed thing, and I think you're meant, again, I think we know that the intention was to think that we're supposed to root for Boxer, but then he becomes more self-absorbed as the movie goes on.
Yeah, as he takes on this persona of Jericho Kane, the character from his screenplay, like, he becomes more and more sort of, like, introspective and, like, withdrawn to his own world by taking on this character. And so, like, he becomes less, like, concerned with what other people are doing and more, like, putting on this, like, machismo sort of, like, pimp and pimps don't commit suicide. And, like, you know, smacking people around and, like, being a badass. Whereas opposed to, like, you know, The Rock is, like, really good in this movie, it should be said.
He's amazing.
And he does this really neat thing where he starts twiddling his fingers together in front of his face and twitching a little bit.
And his eyes are kind of, like, wide open.
As he sort of transitions from, like, Boxer Santeros, this sort of more, like, naive, meek character, into, like, this sort of Jericho Kane persona, who's, like, this fictional movie badass.
Yeah.
And well, so, like, toward the end, it sort of starts to, like, the two kind of collide, and, like, he drifts between them all really quickly. But I think, like, there is a case to be made that as the movie progresses, he's becoming more and more withdrawn into this persona, and therefore becoming less and less concerned with everything else that's happening.
And that was sort of his play against type moment, right? I mean, he's sort of playing this meta comment on the action movie characters The Rock commonly plays.
Right.
Yeah. I think he's also never gotten to play a sort of like neurotic-y type character like that.
And he was great at it.
He really was.
More.
Yeah.
I especially loved, I thought, one of the kind of like crystallized moments of this being a meta comment on this kind of movie is the moment he has with Serpentine, where they're sort of, she's like, he's sort of like, I don't know, like eye-fucking information out of her, essentially. But it did feel like those moments of those kind of action movies where there's like a insanely sexualized femme fatale who's sort of pinned against the bar, and he's like almost kissing her while getting this like information out of her. I was loving that.
Well, he does, and then
he like literally throws her away.
just
shoves her.
Yeah.
What do you think would happen? And then he says, "The fourth dimension will collapse upon itself." You stupid bitch.
He shoves her.
And she also makes this amazing, like,
she has this, like, comic
fall. Yeah, it's a really comical, like, it's not like she's not hurt. She just does this big, goofy, like, whoop, and, like, falls over to the side.
But it's weird the way he delivers this, like, there's no way that he knows that that's what happened. But he says, like, you are, like...
Like, with such authority, like,
dummy.
How'd you not know this, dum-dum?
I will also say, I thought Lee said something that was very spot on about Bai Ling as Serpentine in this movie, is Does Bailyn act, or does Bailyn just be Bailyn?
I don't know
on
if you
screen?
Hire her to act.
Yeah, I think you hire her to be Bailyn.
Yeah,
to because, be like this crazy force of nature.
Because you guys, she was Bailyn all over yeah. the place in this movie.
Well, and like also, so like there's a lot. There are a fuck ton of allusions to other things in this movie.
So much side boob.
And there's yes, and there's a lot of side boob. But
boob.
There's also like the, one of the big allusions is to the movie, the two a sort of like vaguely sci-fi noir movie called Kiss Me Deadly, which there are a lot of references. To this movie, but like Serpentine, obviously the interaction between Serpentine and the Rock at the end is like it's really evocative of this like sort of noir femme fatale, like uh-huh. this like this attractive woman in this slinky dress who he like has to like seduce this information out of,
right.
And so like as a lot of Richard Kelly's work is, it's a lot of things that he loves sort of like mixed around and regurgitated on screen, and
which is an attractive thing, I actually think.
No, it is, and like again, like it worked well in Donnie Darko, and it works inconsistently here. In the interviews I was reading, one of them were like the interviewer would ask Richard Kelly like all these things, like, oh, what's the deal with that like glowing orb that Katarina
yeah,
was holding?
Yeah, what is that?
It's an antenna for fluid karma, so it creates like a stronger focus on the fluid karma energy.
Is that how she was able to like kind of detach and start prophesizing?
Sure.
I'm just trying to fit it into this
so
world.
So what I'm and like basically anytime he would say like, here's this weird thing, what's the deal with it? Richard Kelly would like instantly be like, oh, it was this. This was this. And so like what I'm curious about, like, and we don't have to go into this in big detail, but is it a good thing to have an explanation for everything in your movie, or should some things be left up for interpretation?
Well, okay. Mm-hmm. This is a very like it gets down to how you write. I think that this is like that's it's got neither nothing to do with should the movie make sense? Yes,
right.
It should make sense is always the answer to that question.
Right. Of course, yeah.
But in some cases, like, people go up to a person who wrote a novel or did a movie, and they say, like, oh, like, so what was the deal with this? And in some cases, the writer would be like, well, I came up with this, I spent hours and hours and hours
on
building
this
my world. Yeah, on this mythos, so I instantly know. And in some cases, the writer would be like, oh, I didn't really like... Like, obviously, like, fantasy and sci-fi, you should probably spend more time world-building than if you're doing, like, a sci-fi, like, a noir detective
yeah.
story.
I will say, it does mean something important to me that Richard Kelly had an answer ready for all those questions, because it means he really did think about it, and that it wasn't something thoughtless that was thrown out there that he could have later played as, oh, it was vague, it was up for interpretation. He at least said, like, no, I meant it to be this.
All that really tells me, honestly, is it's every time he can do that, it's more of an indication that he failed. If you have to, act, like, if he had such a clear vision in his head of what he wanted to tell that he can instantly just be like, oh, that's what this is what that is, and we don't get any of that, then he didn't deliver the message.
Yeah,
if he
totally.
Wanted to tell a story that we could then interpret, and if his answers to that question was like, oh, well, it could be this or it could be that, I was thinking about this when I wrote it, then he succeeded because we are then thinking. But, like, if we are able to make assessments about this movie that are wrong to him,
yeah.
then it's really, like, a sign that, like, he didn't do what he wanted to do.
Right.
That's a problem.
As an extension of that, I don't think that that's necessarily always the best idea. The best approach to storytelling is to say, like, this is what it is and it's nothing else. Like, that there is a word of God because...
Right. Well, see, so there's... In theory, you as the author should be able to say, like, if someone asks you, why did this character use this word instead of this word, you
mm-hmm.
should be able to say,
yeah.
well, they would do it because of this.
You
and,
right.
instinctively know,
yeah.
usually.
And I think, like, that is something that, like, yes, you should do. On the other hand, like, what I think is a little bit that's been brought up before is that you as a reader can find metaphors or, like, symbolism that is not intended.
Right.
And, like, what that is that the author knows what this means to them, but, like, it may not be explicit. And and like you said, this is the reason why that's okay is because it's not something that affects the narrative or the overall enjoyment of the story. Like, if there is some sort of symbolism that you get out of this that the author doesn't get,
mm-hmm.
that's completely fine and that's completely valid as long as you can make that argument.
Right.
Which I think, like, that's... So for something like the little glowing orbs, that is not something that affects the narrative in any way.
Not
like,
really.
You can
no.
wonder what they're about, and that's fine. But I'm not sitting there thinking, like, but why, but why, but why? So, like, I think it's completely fine to leave things up to interpretation.
To
but
an extent.
I do think, yeah, but I do think that you should, as you said, Lee, you should be able to have a very firm grip on what the story is. And, like, if you're not explicit, it can't be in a way that affects the narrative.
Yeah.
You should understand that people are going to watch your movie or read your book and they're going to interpret what they see. And if...
And it might be different from what you intended,
yeah,
which is that's the nature of putting media out there for consumption.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that if you had, like, a specific thing you wanted to get across, then it's not really about did X character die or not because we didn't see their death. It's more about, like, did they get the message? And I don't know what the message was.
Well, and it's upon the creator to make that message clear.
Yeah, and so I really didn't get one.
But I will say this, where I do enjoy something being left to interpretation, as per your question, I liked that the end of the movie we're left wondering, did the world end? Because make us kind of go back and examine things and decide, well, should it have?
No, Richard Kelly says it
Richard Kelly definitively says that the world ends.
And I get that, but I'm saying, have a big disagreement.
Yeah. But the movie is unclear about that. I'm saying, in the movie standing on its own, without Richard Kelly's input after the fact, I think it's an interesting idea that we're not sure.
Well, so I guess what I sort of want to know, and like the gist of what the interviewer was asking when he was like sort of musing about this, is that like, is there something admirable to writing or creating something where you throw something in and you don't have an answer as to why it's in there and it is up to interpretation completely?
I think you can do that.
Yeah, okay.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. There's
there's a sort of like tangent that it seems to be like he says that he's frustrated because Richard Kelly has an answer for every sort of weird detail in this movie. And I think it's a strange thing to be frustrated by.
I do as well.
Sort of unreasonable. I think that plenty of authors can explain everything that they write.
Well, yeah.
And to me that indicates that the writer went in there with an idea about why that was, and then when he found out he did have all these answers, he didn't get what he wanted out of it.
Yeah.
I find it to be very comforting that he had all these answers.
I do too.
Because it means it wasn't just bullshit splattered on a wall, it means there was actually a rhyme and reason to
it. Yeah, a creator should 100% I think be able to justify everything that happened.
I think it's fine either way. I think if you want to explain everything, or you want to come up with every single aspect, and that's how you write, then that's how you write. But I think plenty of writers want to tell stories that are more obscure and have these mysteries in them that they just want to talk about it.
I think to say that, like, it is what it means to you is a valid interpretation, but deep down it should mean something to you as a creator also. Whether or not you want to tell people what
you
that
had
is,
a reason
is up to
for
you.
Putting it in
but you should be able to express it if you wanted to.
If you wanted to, I think is the thing. Like, I think that it's a perfectly valid thing for a creator to say, like,
it means to you.
You decide what it means, but like, you know what it means to you. And if you don't want to tell other people what it means to you, then that's completely fine.
Maybe that's just the nature of interpretation, which maybe the answers that Richard Kelly gave this interviewer were not in line with what the interviewer got from the movie.
Well,
and that would be frustrating,
I
think, as an experience.
I don't want to like call him out, but I have a kind of a problem with the fact that Richard Kelly can say, no, this is a movie, and at the end of it, the world ends. But
that's not bared out in the movie.
When it's not bared out in the movie, because like, you can't really do that. And I don't think you should be allowed to say that's what definitely happens and this is the canon.
I think what you could say is, I didn't see it happen either. It doesn't happen. Definitively in the movie, it does not happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's suggested as a possibility, but you do not see that definitively happen.
Well, I mean, I suppose maybe the argument is just that because they are holding hands, we know that the world will end.
But
we haven't really been informed of that as
a...
Exactly. We haven't been informed of that as a definite outcome of that.
Yeah.
I suppose, but everyone says, and The Rock says it was such...
Well, The Rock is an idiot.
I know. But I'm just saying,
you're
like...
You're so right, though, because the movie stacks the deck against certainty.
It does. I really think that,
because the only information you get out of that is theory from the people who know and certainty from dumbasses. So we don't know for sure what happened.
But yeah, basically no one up to and including Richard Kelly can tell me that that's how the movie ended. I'm allowed to say how the movie ended
I think the difference could sort of be split here. I think he could say, I feel this is how it would have ended, but I understand how someone could feel otherwise.
Yeah. And I could also agree that that's a poor choice if that's how we intended the story to end.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I fully believe.
All
on board with. Listen, especially if he's doing this Book of Revelations thing, I think it's like a bad. I think it was a terrible decision to think that through.
Well, and it's weird too because the Book of Revelation is the end.
It's the end, but there's like there's.
And it would seem weird that if he's
a message of positivity in the Book of Revelations that does not exist in this
movie. Well, and I was going to say, it would seem weird that if he's going to tell that story and he's going to create this cynical world in which we are coming up short with good people in a cast. Castless as long as two arms.
Yeah,
it seems weird that he would then say no. The world, I don't know.
Maybe he's taking
no time for stories that are this cynical and have nothing good to say about the world or the possibilities in it.
So maybe he's taking like the serpentine theory in the sense that like this
it's all
is the best
end.
Solution. Like the best possibility is for this world to end.
That if we had that far in this direction,
but the
which actually, you know what, when you put it like that,
in a weird way, like
I don't disagree.
Yeah, in a weird way, also. Like, it's sort of like, I don't want to say that's optimistic because it's not, but like, in a weird way, like, it's slightly more affirming than the sense that, like, Like, you know, like...
We'll continue on under Baron Westphalen.
This is what is best for us. It's best for us to all stop than it is for us to carry on.
Well, A, what I really disagree with there is the idea that there is nothing salvageable in humanity.
No, of course.
I
agree with you,
of course.
It's this hypothetical version of
humanity.
What
I disagree with in the ending still, if that's the case, is the way that they interpret the end of the world, which is that the entire universe ends, which is, like, weird to me because, like, maybe there's other planets and other galaxies
that are doing better than
fine.
We are.
Right? Like,
no, I would love that.
I mean, there's
I would
also,
love that.
Well, I think that also has a lot to do with the fact that, like, as this is the book of Revelation, everything relates to us and on this earth as
yeah.
related to
but
Jesus.
But specifically,
so, like,
they talk about the entire universe.
Yeah.
But maybe that's supposed to be a reflection of human self-importance.
I'm really hung up on that.
Can I get into one more diss thing?
Sure.
The names in this movie are completely absurd.
Well, they're nuts.
Well, yeah, I don't mind.
Some of them are funny.
Yeah.
Some of them are
enjoyable, but I think, on the whole, they are so opaque and so ridiculous that they're hard to remember because everyone's name is the same.
See, I remembered everyone's name because they were so ridiculous, honestly. Like, it's like watching Mad Max or something. Like, everyone's name is Goofy, and I'm okay with it. And there's also, there's this weird, he's, put a lot of weird thoughts, I think, into, what their names mean. Like, how, her name is Nana May Frost, and she's, this authoritarian mother figure. Yeah, and you have, like how Lee pointed out earlier that Roland and Ronald, when you take away the two, the letters that have been flopped around in their names, you have two Rhodes, and there's
right.
a lot of, Robert Frost. Yeah, Senator,
it's everywhere.
Senator Bobby Frost. Like, there's a lot of references
to
this.
And who quotes him.
Yeah, they quote it a lot. I mean, you have I think that the names... I like the names in this.
I don't.
We'll transition to, things that we like talking about this, because, frankly, I think the names are fun, and they're ridiculous, but, it's a ridiculous movie, and I think Richard Kelly, acknowledges that it's a ridiculous movie.
Yeah.
I
appreciate, by the way.
I don't think anyone's arguing that it's not.
Smallhouse is the most Dickensian name in this list.
No one's arguing that it's not between us and Richard Kelly.
Remember, we had talked about a friend of ours who had seen this movie in theaters.
Yeah, no, I think she got it.
Yeah, and she had said something like that. She had said basically if it's a satire, it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. But if this is meant to be taken seriously, it's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, but she loved it.
She loved it because it
in a multifaceted, complicated
honestly,
way.
You guys, I think my opinion is it's a little of column A, a little of column B.
Yeah. So, well, what else do you like though? What do you like in it?
I think the performances are top notch.
Yeah, I think the acting is.
I think around the entire movie, everyone is very good in this.
They're
movie.
Turning in. Fantastic performances.
Yeah, there's a varying degree that you could argue about how much certain people get what the movie is, but I think everyone gets their character.
I think
well.
Even the campier ones who are kind of playing it a little big are still giving a lot to love.
Everyone gets really fun character moments, I think, too. I love when Boxer is trying to take the screenplay from Katarina, he struggles with her for a little bit and she smacks his hands.
No.
And then when he takes it away, she shakes her finger out and is
Great.
Everyone just they have such goofy little indulgences.
Some of the weird for weird sake is really works.
Yeah.
Even in the midst of this weird for weird sake movie, honestly, Mandy Moore's performance as Madeline Frost was very naturalistic.
Yeah, the way she delivers the line about so we kind of give him
whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Because it's when she's talking about having to black the blackmail thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a natural reaction.
It's a rational response to the situation.
Where she's just like, I don't fucking know, guys.
Yeah.
Just end this.
It's a great line delivery. Characters like Pilot are genetically engineered for me to latch onto. That's why I want more of them partially.
Mysterious.
Well, yeah, these standoffish. They don't have much to do with the rest of the story,
right.
But
he's
they seem
outside
they're
everything
else. Omniscient,
yeah.
And they don't they're.
There's a lot of implied
troubled.
Power that they have.
Yeah, and they seem so. I had this, and I'll get more into this in my fix. But the way that you see him with the gun turret, I remember when I had first seen this and I paid half attention to it, I was like, then when I came back to this movie, I was like, so he's a sniper, right? But he's not really a sniper?
But sort of is.
Sort of. Well, he's a guard.
Yeah, he still works for the military, it would seem.
He works for the military.
But, and he is stationed, outside
but
the
But that's
Utopia.
Not a sniper rifle. That's just,
it's
a crazy gun.
It functions sort of as one because there's a sniper scope on it and it shoots at incredibly long range.
Yeah.
And very precisely. So I'd say
in function,
he is a sniper.
He's guarding one place the entire time. His station, whatever he is, never moves. But, when I watched the movie the first time, I remember, is he, just watching everyone? Because you just shots of him after a scene of just him looking through.
Yeah, there's a lot of just close-up shots of, like, the upper half of his body with his gun. And so you don't have, like...
He's like the watcher.
Yeah, you don't have... You don't have, like, an explicit...
The observer of the world, really.
Clear view of, like, that he is always on a turret. Like, if it had been revealed later on that he was moving, like, a large gun from place to place and sitting on rooftops, like, sense. I would have been like, yeah he was.
Mm-hmm. He's setting up shop somewhere and, like, watching people. And this is getting into a dangerous territory because this song is terrible and we shouldn't be advocating it. But, like, the sort of, like, idea of there being this, like, surreal sequence where, like, he's...
Drugged out,
and there's, like, a song
PTSD.
Playing. And there's, like, dance. There's, like, you know, there's a dance number
happening. Sexy Marilyn Monroe nurses.
Sexy dancing. There was, like... something to do there, but it just wasn't done the way I would do it, or at all, like, with the song choice that I would have picked.
Do you know what it sort of reminded me of when I was watching it? Did either of you guys ever see Across the Universe, the Julia Taymor movie?
Yeah.
It reminded me of the Happiness is a Warm Gun sequence, because it was another PTSD on drugs, sexy nurses dancing around.
Yeah, but that's like a bad apple orange to a bad...
I love apple oranges.
My fucking words collapsed on
bad there. Apples to bad oranges.
Bad apples to bad oranges is exactly what I was trying to say.
But I just love bad apple orange.
This movie is a bad apple
orange. Sound like it would be like
she said a
that sounds like breakdown. That sounds like the name of like a really bad hard cider.
Bad apple orange.
Yeah,
but that's neither of those are good. Like there's good like. Music video sequences in movies like
it reminded me weirdly of Tommy at certain like points like the surreal weird like especially when Amazing Journey in the beginning of Tommy when they're like at an amusement park or something like it just like there's a lot of surreal weirdness to it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense and like so like it evoked that too. I don't think that was intentional but like that's what it reminded me of.
Tommy also kind of established that as something that's what the world was. That's not what they do in this movie. That only really happens I would say 1.5 times.
Well, that's because it's a dream sequence.
But I kind of wanted more. If they were gonna do it, don't just do it once.
Well, I have a reason. Like, there, I think that should have been, which it wasn't, was like a what happens when you take fluid karma. And I think it would have been
as an explanation.
Yeah, I think it would have been cool for there to be things that happen in that dream sequence that are things that we see later on in the movie because he is seeing the future. Other good things.
Like, with, like, because I feel like we might just be transitioning to fixes at a certain point.
We should transition to fixes. There are times when you'll laugh and you're meant to laugh. And there are times that you are, like...
Not meant to laugh, but you will also laugh.
Yeah, there is that, but I think that a lot of this stuff is enjoyable to sit through.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I do think that there are not a lot of unintentional laughs. When there are things that go wrong, it's a sort of head-scratching things that are going wrong.
Yeah.
Like, and if you are laughing at something, I think you are supposed to be laughing at it.
I'll put this out there as something I liked. I enjoyed the movie... Even though I found it to be just hopelessly scattered and messy. I could not make heads or tails of what I was seeing, but I enjoyed a lot of what I was
seeing. They're enjoyable shrapnel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an enjoyable shotgun blast. Yeah. Like, it's just sort of like, it's going everywhere. It's a humongous mess.
It's a lot of crazy bits.
I could not tell you what these bits add up to, but I was enjoying each individual bit.
It makes you roll your eyes and go, you dumb that made this movie. But, like, at the same time, it's still fun into it.
You beautiful dumb. Yeah, get over here.
I feel like I leave this movie thinking, like, Richard Kelly is, like, a genius, but, like, he just got so bogged down in this movie and in this universe that he just, like, could not properly do it at the end of the day.
I think the three of us... went too far.
I think... You've gone too far, Cherry.
You've gone too far.
Richard.
That's a great Claudette line. But it is... I think the three of us can agree that there are amazing, brilliant ideas happening here. But like you said, the cup was runneth over. It was way too much.
And maybe had this been a TV show or a bunch of graphic novels instead, this would have worked better.
Yeah.
Let's use that as a transition into fixes.
Okay.
Because I would like to start with mine because mine strikes that very note that you just brought up.
Go for it.
My fix... Jinx. My fix in this movie is to completely change mediums. This cannot be a movie. There's way too much happening.
Mm-hmm.
To give anything enough room to breathe and fully be explained and understood and really kind of fit together, there needs to be a lot more space. It could potentially work as like a miniseries or a TV show, but for me, there's so much high concept mythology happening, I think it would fit best as a graphic novel. I know some prequel stuff exists that way. I think the entire run should be that. I think a lot of this crazy mashup of vague ideas would play out a lot better on a page than it does in the moving screen. He could use that to his great advantage to fully clarify all of this. And I think when made clear, this could be a truly brilliant whole. Because there are definitely elements here that shine gorgeously that could still shine on the page and you can lose a lot of the crap that gets in the way. I think ambiguity and confusion is this movie's biggest enemy that it creates itself. And, you know, with a graphic novel, take as long as you want to explain this shit.
Yeah.
You can build on those prequels. That can be where you start. And then this world makes sense. So my general fix is make it a graphic serial and really go to town on this mythology. Give it breathing room, give it space, give it lots of love. And I think this could turn into something really special.
I think that's a good fix. Like, honestly, if I found out that, like, there was going to be, like, a graphic novel version of this.
Like, I would run out and buy it.
I'd be there like day one. If there was like a mini series being made of this, like I would totally watch
this. I would
this.
Prefer, me too. If you were doing a longer thing, and then I would prefer, I think, a TV miniseries.
I think like I would go for
like
TV
a Netflix
miniseries.
Thing.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Like maybe like a two series Netflix series.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
because
it would give you so much more breathing room. Like I would watch that 100%.
No more than 20 hours.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think, yeah, like, I don't want this to go on,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
endlessly,
no, 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 no,
but,
no.
like, I think that, like, one season's probably too short,
yeah.
and so two would probably be just right.
But it made me think of the graphic novel thing, not only when you, it definitely started me on that path when you mentioned the prequels being graphic novels, but the thing that really got to me about that is, I found myself feeling a lot of the same feelings about this movie that I felt while watching Watchmen, whereas there was a lot of brilliant stuff happening, but it just was too much for 2+ hours. And if you're really going to adapt, then that's a graphic novel from the start. If you're going to adapt that, it needs a miniseries. It needs a lot of space. So I was kind of thinking about this in reverse. I was like, well, we're starting with this problem. Let's put that in a graphic novel where it can be that way. So anyway, yeah.
Lee, do you want to go?
Yeah. So I have less, like, I don't have a lot of answers for my fix, but, like, I also, like, I know what I think needs to be done to the movie, and I don't have a lot of time to, like, assuage auteur sensibilities with Richard Kelly, so, like, I know that, like, he had a very specific idea of what he wanted to do, but, like, I think that it's not hard to tell a condensed revelation story in this sort of post-9/11 world. I think you need to cut a lot of characters, you can pick and choose which ones, there's a lot of them that could go and a lot that you could stay, depending on what you want to focus on in the end. I think you need the central boxer and Ronald Roland thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the sci-fi element, weirdly enough. Like, I like that there's this, like, anomaly that creates this duplicate Ronald. Because I want there to be that element of him forgiving himself in the end. I think that's really important.
It's beautiful.
I want Pilot to have more presence, physical presence in the story. And, like, more, I think he is pretty important now. But, like, I want to increase that importance and
mm-hmm.
have him have more presence in the movie. I had this idea, like, one of the first ideas I had to what I thought would be a fun thing is how he's seen watching people through the, like, the gun turret a lot. And I had this idea that if he was death or if he was some other figure in the Revelations, that, like, it almost seems like he could be a sniper that's, like, studying a target before he kills it.
Right.
But there's, like, a struggle the whole time of, like, whether or not he's actually gonna
pull
the trigger on it. And that target could be Boxer or it could even be Ronald. And it'd be interesting if he was debating whether or not to kill his old best friend, who was the one responsible for giving it to him, and if he ultimately decides not to do it, is an interesting arc to follow. It's an interesting lens through which our narrator to be, like, telling the story. Because I think I would keep him as a narrator. I like that element of it. I think definitely, like, characters to cut, definitely Starla. Like, stop naming, don't have bodies that don't need to be there. Like, there don't need to be, like, 4 scientists that work for Baron von Westdale, and you can just have Baron.
We also don't need Fortunio Balducci.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of neo-Marxists, like, that could be nameless, like, pawns that aren't, and I think that you just focus on this raw idea of, like, politics coming to a head with revolution, and through it all, there's these two characters that have gone through this anomaly that are coming into place as the sort of, like, false prophet and second coming of Christ. And I think the biggest change I would make is just a general tonal shift, which is that I think it is too cynical. I think that I would put more emphasis on, yes, like, things are all, like, people are going all a bit nuts and the world's gonna come to an end, but, like, there is something salvageable in this mess, or there's something to look for at the end of the tunnel. So I don't think that we got that sense in the movie. Part of the one part of that line at the end that he says that you missed out was that, like, he was, like, his name was Roland blah blah blah, he was my best friend, and then he does the pimp committing suicide thing. But, like, I thought it was, like, a beautiful moment that, like, the character who narrates the movie, you know, after we see Ronald forgive himself, Pilot, like, affirms that, like, yes, this is, like, my best friend, and I don't resent him for, like, what he did to me. So there was that, but, like, that was, like, a scrap of meat to a starving person. Like, I need more of that in this. But that's basically what I feel about my fix.
Okay. There's a lot of points that you bring up that I think are really good. Obviously, one that I think we can all agree on is simplifying characters. Yes. Like you had said, that there are characters, like, I think you could probably combine Cindy Pinzicki and Zora Carmichael mm-hmm. to an extent, I mm-hmm. think. Starla, as we said, needs not be there. I think, like, so what we kind of, like, there's, like, an interesting sort of, like, thing to discuss where the idea is, like, if you are, for certain movies like this especially, if you're trying to fix them, you have to ask yourself, like, what is the author trying to say? For something like Jack the Giant Slayer, it doesn't really matter because that is, like, a narrative story. Mm-hmm. And, like, your fixes are things like these plot points should be, like, more emphasized on, or this character doesn't have enough to do, right. and things like that. For something like this, where there's not a very clear narrative and where it's clearly a very personal project, I think the question needs to be, for me at least, more of, like, what did you want to say when you gave us this? And so he wants to say so many things in here. And what I guess, I suppose, what I find the most interesting in terms of what this is the idea of a retelling of the Book of Revelation. So I kind of am really into the idea of people who are not, I don't pretend to understand, like, I don't know if he's a religious person at all, but, like, the idea of people sort of creating, like, this kind of non-religious interpretation, mm-hmm. Like, that's in a lot of things. Like, the entire premise of, really, of Jesus Christ Superstar is the idea that, like, it's Jesus treated as a real person, as, like, a rock star. Mm-hmm. And, like, there is also, there was a show on NBC a couple years ago called Kings.
Yes!
Yeah, starring Lovejoy. And, yeah, it was like King David and Saul, and it was like mm-hmm. put in this sort of alternate U.S. like where all the countries had different names, and they were like based in New York City, like they lived in like what is the New York Public Library and stuff like that, like, and it was like this really neat sort of like alternative futuristic take on like on something from the Bible, and frankly,
I thought
it
was like, really
cool. I did too, and like really that's what I would kind of like from this. Like I would like a Book of Revelation sort of set in this kind of like alternate future. Like I don't want any real ties to any real world events in this movie. Like I don't want to hear about like, you know, Bush was the president or like Osama bin Laden or anything like that. Like it should all be divorced from that. And I think that in itself is a very interesting movie. I'd want to see some more clear representations of like who relates to each of these characters, because like I think it's kind of neat that like a lot of these characters probably correlate to figures from the Book of Revelation, but like I just want that to be more explicit. It doesn't need to be super on the nose, but like if you're going with like a color scheme or anything like that, or occupations or that sort of thing, like I enjoy things like that whenever I see adaptations of like comparing like who one character is in the source and who they've been sort of like transplanted to
right.
in the new one. So like frankly, like if that was more explicit, I would kind of like that. I would really want to tone down on the sci-fi aspect of it. I do like the whole sort of like rift in time kind of thing, but I would want to try and find like a better way of doing that. Doesn't necessarily have to also involve this fluid karma concept. It's also a drug that the Baron is making as an alternative
energy
source.
You could even
find
a biblical.
I got really bogged down in that, and I was I got angry when you told me that the fluid karma was a lie.
Yeah,
and that it was really they're really pulling from the end. I'm like, how?
Why?
But the people think that it's the waves.
Yeah,
but they can't. But how do they? Like,
right,
it's going
like
nuts.
It's so much.
My brain melted.
And was that also supposed to be like an oil comment too? Sort of like
I don't
really understand about her energy source.
But I just it's so much that I just don't really want in this story. So like there can be a little bit of sci-fi in the sense that it's this alternative world, but I don't want it to be too much. Like I love the Roland Ronald thing, and I think that's definitely something I would want to keep.
I think it's the best plot element of the
I
movie.
Do too. And like frankly, like I would probably consider a version of this where Boxer is not duplicated, because like I don't think it does.
It's not necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only reason why he did is that as a false prophet, you want to believe that like there are two of him as there are two of, like, the Christ figures. So, like, it could be either one of them.
And it makes sense in terms of, like, his double died, whereas
but we also don't learn that until the very end.
Yeah,
anyway.
So, like, I don't think it's that important. Like, it's interesting sort of thought, and I'm sure that was the reason behind it, but, like, I don't need it. So, really, what I just want...
don't need it.
Yeah. I just want this sort of adaptation of the Book of Revelations in an alternate future with these characters and these, like, these interesting ideas being expressed in a much more... linear and direct way.
I think that's a really cool thing.
Because
I would actually say it invites more criticism when it tries to tie itself so closely to, at the time, existent political realities and real people.
Mm-hmm.
Would we recommend this?
I think so. I would recommend it. It's long, but you know what? It's you'll laugh.
Yeah.
You'll laugh.
It's
you'll,
crazy.
You'll cry.
You'll
crazy
think.
You'll love.
People say
you'll
ridiculous
hate.
Shit.
Yeah.
People say such lines as, I'm a pimp and pimps don't commit suicide.
They say it twice.
Nobody
Three
rocks
times.
The clock like fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Nobody rocks the clock. clock like Krista now. Or Cindy Pinzicki.
Rocks the clock. That's like the Fonz.
Or you... Okay, can we talk about the crow... All right. Get out of my ice cream truck, you Cro-Magnum bitch. And in the subtitles, it was written like the bird dash the gun.
Dash the gun, yes.
Magnum.
Magnum bitch.
Dash bitch.
I don't
know
which is correct, but either way, I'm intrigued.
Would that not be like a great like Riot Girl band, Cro-Magnum bitch?
Yes.
Someone go back in time to when Riot Girl bands were a thing.
I would, yeah, no, I agree with you. I would honestly, I would also recommend this. The first time I saw this movie, I was just so frustrated and angry. Yeah. The second time, I really started to come around. And honestly, by this point, and when we were finished with this fucking whiteboard, I was just sitting here staring at this, thinking like, this is like the genius lunatic ravings.
Yeah.
Like I feel like in a weird sense, like I'm reading a book that was translated from Russian or something.
Right.
So like there are a lot of cultural references I'm missing out on.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's not always good, but it's always fascinating. Like,
yeah.
It is, like, in the fact that it, like, has incited this much weird discussion and arguments over who these characters are, I think is the mark of something. It might not always be good, but it's the mark of something, like, very interesting. And, like,
yeah.
Honestly,
yeah.
Like, I like Richard Kelly a lot, I think, really. Like, I think he is, like, it's a unique, weird voice, and it's something that I think we need. And, frankly, like, I hope he does more stuff soon, because he's done nothing really since The Box. And I would like to see him do something, because I think we are better off with, like, someone who is intensely weird but intensely personal in what they're doing.
This movie also has something for everyone. It has the really crazy lines you can laugh at. It has the ridiculous weird shit you can boggle at. It has interesting statements you can think about. It has interesting statements that fail to be made that you can also think about. And that's why I think I would recommend it. It's a long movie.
I won't say it doesn't feel long. It feels its length. I think when you get to be like over 2 hours long, it's gonna feel that way. Like,
yeah, there's no really dancing around.
There's no
that.
Speeding that up.
Yeah. There is a weird part of me, though. Like, I kind of wish I could see the can cut, you know? Like,
yeah, I want to see all that footage.
I do, too. I want to see, like...
If it exists...
Yeah.
I would love
it. I want to see, like, the 3.5-hour version of this or something, but, like, nothing cut from it. Like, I would just be... It'd be fascinating to me.
I have a feeling I would love Janine Garofalo in this movie.
She's fun. There's if you go on YouTube... So, if you go on YouTube, you can find a lot of the deleted scenes. I don't think all of them.
Yeah,
you can
what's the scene dungeon master
or
something?
No, what's the game dungeon
master?
What's the game dungeon master?
Yeah, she says... Her catchphrase, what's the game dungeon master?
That's a fucking great catchphrase.
It is a great catchphrase. And, like, you can see the original, like, prologue of the movie and like, just some other snippets that were cut out. And I don't think it's everything, but it's some interesting stuff if you want to see it.
Yeah.
You guys...
All right, I'm ready to, like...
We dug deep tonight.
Yeah.
Take so many naps right now.
Yeah. What we should also say is, again, Facebook.
Mm.
Facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. Twitter is also Why Watch Podcast. We're working on our website still. We're trying to
it's up.
Some of the
you can
yeah.
go there now.
Yeah,
I permit it.
Yeah, okay. All right. So go to www.dratpack.com,
yeah.
Which we're hoping to do some more stuff with. We're going to throw some of the older recipes and things like that up there.
We're going to start. My first official article, I think, is going to be my
defense of Bunraku.
Postmortem defense of Bunraku.
Yeah.
But we're going to do some more interesting stuff on there.
Yeah, we want to. Yeah.
Other types of content. There may be Let's Plays eventually.
Oh, yeah. There might be.
There might be some Let's Plays.
Yeah, we just want to try and make it, just put some stuff out there. So,
yeah.
Like, by all means, if you guys are interested in anything we're doing, like, check out DratPack.com.
And Tumblr is dead for us.
Tumblr is dead. Long live DratPack.com.
Tumblr's...
We good?
Yeah.
We're good.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
It's the Midwest Kid.